Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode 466 with my guest, Brian Simpson. I am Paul Gilmartin. And this here podcast, this in here thing is the Mental Illness Happy Hour. It's a place for honesty about all the battles in your head, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction, to simple everyday compulsive negative thinking. I'm not a therapist. I'm a former stand-up comedian and TV host. I'm still a professional jackass. And this podcast is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. It's a peer-to-peer thing. And we've been doing it 9 years. God, I can't believe it's been that long. I've had one of those weeks that is just Christmassy. And for those of you that don't enjoy Christmas, you know what I mean. I have that feeling like when I see lights go up or somebody getting excitedly talking about Christmas, I just feel left behind. It's a feeling like standing out in the backyard, looking in through the window at everybody having a party that you're not invited to. And I think it's easy to kind of adopt a cynical attitude about Christmas or the holidays but for so many of us, we're not exaggerating. It just really is something to be endured rather than something to look forward to. And I wish I looked forward to it. But I think the catastrophizing part of our brain has so much past information to load that the pictures it creates in anticipation of Christmas moments, it's pretty based in fact. But I think it also keeps us kind of in that place where we're listening to the fear in our body rather than just being open to a potential moment that changes our view of what Christmas is. I don't know. I've just been feeling numb, a bit melancholy, and really having trouble getting things done. Dishes piling up, not making the bed, waking up at 1:30. I'm still going to my support group meetings, still sharing with people, but still feeling that there's something I'm missing, some key to unlock the numbness and the detachment that I'm feeling that I just can't see or I'm too lazy to pursue. And so on top of feeling numb and detached, I also feel lazy and stupid. And that can count as multitasking, thinking those four things at the same time. You know, I've been sharing with my, maybe this would be a good place to plug our sponsor, BetterHelp.com. I've been sharing all of this with my therapist, and one of the things that she helps me with is kind of to separate what are the facts on the ground from what are my negative self-beliefs, what are the things that I tell myself that keep me stuck. And sometimes there is no way out other than through it and just kind of enduring it and waiting for it to change. But sometimes there are negative self-beliefs that I have that I need to look at. And regarding BetterHelp.com, if you want to check it out, go to BetterHelp.com/mental and fill out a questionnaire. Make sure you include the /mental part so they know you came from this podcast. And then fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor they think is a good match for you, they'll match you up with one. And then you can experience a free week of counseling to see if online counseling is right for you. And you need to be over 18. Anyway, I know there's a lot of you that relate to it, and sending you some love. We have some, I'm going to load up most of the surveys before the interview here, and we have some great awfulsome moments. For those of you that are new to the podcast, an awfulsome moment is something that was awful at the time, but in hindsight, kind of makes you chuckle, or there was some, you know, silver lining to it. And this one was filled out by a woman who calls herself Can't Find My Keys. And she writes, I once dated a guy who had a micropeen. We'd been friends for a while, and we had a lot of mutual friends who would hang out together often. And this guy had been courting me pretty persistently for a long time. He was incredibly tall, wore size 13 shoes, and I discovered only after we had started dating that he had the penis of a very small child. But I really liked him. And I wanted to protect his manhood, so I didn't make a big deal about it and just tried to have a normal sex life. I even went online and special ordered a box of Trojan Snug Fit extra small condoms, and I would open the packet and toss it before he could see the packaging just so I wouldn't make him feel bad about his small appendage. One morning after a bit of a drunken sleepover, he seemed extra concerned about the fact that he could not find the condom we had used the night before. It's probably down the side of the bed or something, I muttered and rolled over. He was pretty insistent that it was nowhere to be found and that it might be up inside me. I'd never heard of such a thing, but I went to the bathroom to have a dig around and nothing. Still, he was insisting it might be up there. So then I had him dig around for it and still nothing. But throughout that day, he just kept insisting that I should probably go to a clinic and just have them check to make sure. In hindsight, I realize that this probably wasn't the first time this had happened to him, even with the special extra small condoms. So I went to have one of the most embarrassing clinical experiences imaginable, where I had to put my legs in stirrups and let a random male clinic doctor pull out the forceps and get right up there. And sure enough, pulled out a used condom that was lodged so far up my vagina that it couldn't be reached without the help of a doctor's forceps. The doctor claimed this happens all the time, but it's possible he was just trying to ease the awkward tension. He then commended me for coming in so soon because many women don't realize this has even happened until days later when it starts to stink to high heaven. Sorry for that visual. About a week later, I was looking around for my keys and couldn't find them anywhere, and my underendowed boyfriend said to me, "Did you check inside your vagina?" Oh my God. Something you don't hear very often is men talking about a partner's vagina being too large. And I wonder if that's a bit of a double standard. Because there's a bit of a punchline quality to recalling some guy having a small penis. But you know, I wondered if you were in the same group of let's say people at a cocktail party and you were anonymous sharing about an anonymous person that you had sex with that. And let's hope you're doing this around people you've never met before. And you were sharing about somebody that you had sex with that had a micro penis. I'm sure it would elicit laughter. But I wonder if instead of that conversation, somebody talked about somebody that had a really large vagina, if it would get the same reaction, if it would still be considered punchline worthy. I don't know. Just a thought. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a non-binary person who calls themselves assigned fuck up at birth. And they write, I'm from London, but I have a large extended Irish family. Every year in the run-up to Christmas, I find myself at gatherings of 30 to 40 relatives that create the perfect cocktail of alcohol, passive aggression, unprocessed family trauma, and hours together in overcrowded terrace houses. Usually, as a queer person with borderline personality disorder and as a survivor of sexual violence by an intimate partner, these events are a nightmare. I find the noise alone too much to deal with, and then I have to spend hours being asked questions about my future, when will I have kids and a husband, people speculating about how well I am. Like most people, it feels like family. It feels like family know exactly how to push my buttons. This year, the first of many Christmas parties set an all-time record, and for once, it was so awfulsome, all I could do was laugh. Sitting, eating pineapple and cheese on a stick, my aunt gave me a small, lovingly wrapped present. I thanked her and said she shouldn't have. I didn't realize how prophetic that comment would be. I carefully unwrapped the shiny box, only to find a small, gray, plastic rape alarm. Amongst the noise, no one had seen it but my sister, who sat next to me. We met each other's eyes, and part of me wanted to just break down. What was my aunt thinking? My family all know my history. Instead, me and my sister just started laughing, and I whispered to her, 5 years too late. Still reeling, we made a beeline for the garden where we had a smoke. My dad's girlfriend was there, and after 5 minutes, she turned to my hyper-body-conscious sister and asked if she had put on weight. Later, when the party was over, my sister messaged me and said, what a fucking afternoon, right? I texted back, I know, right? I'm so glad you were there, though. She said, me too. We weren't always the closest of siblings, but the day made me remember that she has my back and that she's willing to remind me that it's not all in my head. We won't stop being a dysfunctional, sprawling family anytime soon, but sometimes we can laugh through the more surreal moments. Oh, that is fantastic. That is the capper. Did you put on some weight? That's like out of a movie. Out of a movie. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Thank you for that. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Poopsaroni, and she writes, a recent awfulsome moment from my life is when my long-term boyfriend, who I had lived with for a year and a half, told me late at night that he didn't want to be in a relationship anymore. Both of us went into panic. I had a really intense panic attack that felt like I was dying. I could not breathe. And then he ran to the bathroom to throw up. When he got back from the bathroom, I ran to the bathroom to poop. This happened 3 more times over the next 10 minutes or so, alternating between him vomiting and me pooping right after him. The decision he made to end our relationship has been incredibly terrible and painful for me, and I had to move out of our home and leave our dog, but there is something about that night that just makes me laugh because it is so funny to me that we took turns running to the toilet to stress vomit or poop and then back to the bedroom to keep talking and crying. And I have not had a normal poop since then, and this happened about 6 weeks ago. Oh, you guys are giving me Christmas presents early. A good awfulsome moment is like any survey that moves me or makes me laugh or makes my jaw drop is a little tiny Christmas present. One of our sponsors for today is REMrise. A lot of us struggle with sleep, getting good quality sleep, falling asleep when we want to fall asleep, and REMrise can help you with that. It's a personalized sleep solution, and it uses natural plant-based formulas to help calm the mind, relax the body, and get your circadian rhythm on track for a better, more restorative sleep. It's drug-free. There's no groggy side effects. I can tell you that. I've made it a part of my nighttime routine, and they will customize based on the input you give them. You take a little quiz online and they'll ask you questions like, do you find yourself ruminating when you're having trouble falling asleep, et cetera, et cetera. And the one that they recommended for me is one called Power Off because apparently I have trouble shutting my brain down, turning my motherboard off when I lay down at night. So all you have to do, go to getremrise.com/mental, take their free quiz. And there's also a digital app that you can use to track your sleep progress. And it also includes guided meditation. So check out REMrise today. Go to getremrise.com/mental, take their sleep quiz. And when you guys sign up, you'll get your first week of REMrise free. And all you have to pay for is shipping. And you won't find an offer like this anywhere else. Get your first week of REMrise for free when you sign up at getremrise.com/mental. That's getremrise.com/mental. And then this is one more survey before we get to the interview with Brian Simpson. And this is an awfulsome moment filled out by a woman who calls herself Sunflower. And she writes, I grew up in a dysfunctional household with an abusive dad and a codependent mother who was a victim of sexual abuse. So it wasn't so surprising that I felt like I had to lose my virginity right after I turned 15 years old. So 8 days after my birthday, which happened to be Valentine's Day, I had my boyfriend come over. My mom was out of town visiting my stepdad. This boyfriend was 18 years old, had a Dawson's Creek haircut, played Dungeons and Dragons, and was goofy as fuck. But he was sweet and funny, so I was, quote, in love, I guess. Boyfriend had his dad drop him off that night, and we go into my room and start to mess around. He wanted to go down on me, and I was hesitant and nervous because it made me uncomfortable, but I let him anyways. So I'm laying on my back on top of the covers, completely naked, and he is not, and he looks up right at me before he starts and asks me, who won the presidential election? Without thinking, I answer, Bush. I then tell him to get the fuck out of my house. I was mortified. So he leaves my house and at 10 o'clock at night in the cold on foot to walk about 4 or 5 miles up in the mountains of Central California. Did I feel bad? No, I did not. No wonder he was a virgin. But don't worry, I ended up losing my virginity a few months later after a 420 party to a Slipknot-loving, pot-smoking 16-year-old guy who, a few years later after our relationship, was expelled from school and ended up on house arrest for accidentally starting a fire with a cigarette. And no, there was no Bush.
Nobody's cool and everyone's scared. And we're just all in this together. There was no joy. Overeating.
Apathy doesn't leave any marks.
Numbing out.
Physically.
I wish that I was a girl.
Panic attacks were so violent.
Rudderless. They were mistaken for seizures.
Shock coke in my neck.
The TV was talking to me.
Romantically, I am becoming the woman that I feared.
He said, there's going to be a second hunger strike.
Nothing's real.
And I'm going to die.
Sometimes I just go, hey, I can't deal.
Just beyond broken.
I'm one out.
You have to, like, fantasize about the person I'm with.
I'm gonna stab him.
Fucking someone else.
It's okay to be different.
That I don't want to die is a miracle.
To be weird.
I'm so happy to be here.
I'm gonna help you one day. People are gonna love you for that.
It takes a lot of work to heal.
It's hard being a weird kid.
Sometimes you don't realize how fucked up something was until you feel the opposite of it.
You will just never see what you're not looking for.
I didn't know how to break up with him, so I just transferred schools.
I'm here with Brian Simpson, who somebody turned me on to. I think it was Rye Doon, who was a guest a couple of months back. It was some comedian, and I can't remember.
It was Rye Doon, yeah.
I think so. But he said, you got to interview this guy. He's a stand-up comic. He served in Iraq, and he deals with depression. And I was like, check, check, check. And then I just watched your stand-up the other day, the set from David Spade's show. What's the name of his show again?
Lights Out.
Lights Out. Yeah. And I was telling Brian as we were munching in the kitchen, very little stand-up comedy makes me laugh or surprises me, and I so enjoyed your set. It was just so refreshing and just great. It's just great. You're really dry wit, great writer, and great thinker. And my favorite comics are the ones that really just kind of think outside the box. They have a way of looking at things that I guess that sounds kind of obvious, but anyway, I just wanted to gush about your stand-up for a little bit on mic.
Thank you.
Where do we start? You're from Maryland.
I am. I'm from Maryland.
And then you lived in San Diego for a while when you joined the Marines. But let's start with Maryland. What was life like growing up where in Maryland?
I grew up in PG County, Maryland, Southern Maryland, which is basically like the D.C., Maryland, Virginia circle there. I was in foster care from a very young age. So just a lot of bouncing around, home to home to home to home to home to home to home.
Holy shit.
You know, and so I, you know, whether it be family members or strangers or whatever, I must have moved probably 14 times.
How many different sets of caretakers have you had in your life?
Well, some of them were more than once.
So you go back to somebody?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah. Let me see here. I lived with 1, 2, 3, 4 people. I lived with 4 people twice. So I've never even thought about the how many. So let me see. So probably 9.
Damn.
9 different people.
Where were mom and dad in the picture?
Well, I mean, my mom was in California, ironically. I guess that's not ironic, but no, she was in California, for various reasons. And my dad, I actually lived with my dad for a couple of those years. But it was a whole weird like dynamic, you know what I mean? Where my mom was a teen mom, mm-hmm. and she was living with her mom, who dated abusive men, and she couldn't, you know, take it. And she like burned one of them with an iron, and like, and it turned into this big thing, and she ended up just having to leave, but she couldn't afford to like take us.
I gotcha.
You know, but she knew that her mom wouldn't let anything happen to her. Like, her mom was our best bet. So,
right.
Rather, you know, it was better to her. It was better for us to be with her mom than to be with her out on the road as a teen, you know, as a 18-year-old. You know what I mean? Yeah. So she left us with her mom.
And so did you endure abuse from your grandmother's boyfriends?
No. No, not never. Never. She would put up with a lot of shit from from dudes, but that was one thing where she didn't play that shit. You know, it was like, I mean, seriously, I mean, you know, a dude would, I watched her put up with a lot of abuse, but when it came
towards herself,
Yeah. Right. But,
and it sounds like also towards her daughter.
No, I don't think my mom. No, I don't think so.
Oh, so your mom was sticking up for your grandma.
Right. My mom was sticking up for my grandma. Right.
I got you.
And, you know, because that, you know, that's the weird thing is like, if one of them had done something to one of her kids, I think my grandma would have killed that motherfucker, you know? Yeah. I mean, or maybe they did, you know, because me and my mom never really go that deep into it.
Right.
You know, shit, I could do a whole podcast with my mother probably just talking about all those years, you know?
But
maybe I should. Yeah. Maybe I will. But, you know, Seven said that when my mom was in the picture, I saw my father often, but my grandma didn't like him.
I see.
So when my mom left, I didn't even know where he was or any of that. Like, my grandma was like, nah.
Do you have any memories of what you felt or thought back during those time periods?
I know that, like, there was a series of events in that early time that eroded my trust in authority, you know, and I don't think I've ever really regained that. It's you know, because you still, when you know, even as an adult, even all these years later, you still have to deal with the same, because it's your foundation, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you can't you know, it's so hard to like redo that and relearn how to feel, you know.
Put it so perfectly, and to learn how to trust again, the biggest hurdle is to realize that you're not even trusting.
Yeah,
because it just seems like common sense.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I didn't lose the trust because my mom was always very. She's always been pragmatic, you know. Mm-hmm. So she was always very, and she always respected my intelligence, you know, even when I was very, very young. So she didn't have a problem explaining things to me if I was curious about them.
Were you a little philosopher even back then?
I was. You know, if I wanted to know something, she knew that I would go find out if she didn't tell me. So she didn't tell me like bullshit, like, you know, one time she told me babies came from the cabbage patch. You know, and
you said, then why are you fucking so much?
No, but I came back from school the next day and I told her, and I was like, well, I found out babies come from vaginas. And from that moment on, she was like, okay, look, we'll talk about it. Like when you can, you know, when you know more. And I'm like, all right. But so after that, it's like, if I asked her about something, so anyway, when she left, mm-hmm. She told us that she was, like, she didn't just like disappear. She like sat me and my brother down. I was like, I gotta go. These are the reasons. I'll be back. I promise. Blah, blah, blah. So that didn't damage us. Or at least not me. I've never really spoken to my brother about it either. But then we ended up being home alone one day, and one of the neighbors, somebody else had called the cops and said we were home alone. And that was a weird thing. And we ended up being taken from my grandma because, you know, we were latchkey kids, and we were given to our auntie who lived upstairs, mm-hmm. in the same apartment building. And that was a weird situation too. But then, my brother and I have different fathers, and his father's mom was a foster kid mom. So my auntie, who now all of a sudden had four kids, cause she had two of her own. Now all of a sudden she has four kids. She's like, I can't, Yeah, I can't do that. So she put us in foster care, right? And this is where my trust was fucked up. It's because she told us that we were going to
Six Flags.
No, she told us we were going to, because my brother's grandma lived in the suburbs. Like, so at this point, we living in Southeast DC, Martin Luther King Avenue. And his grandma lived in the suburbs. Like, she had a nice house. She, you know, they had cable. They had Nintendos. You know, it was like they were living good over there. But she was kind of an asshole. So it was like one of them things where it was like we visited. It was good for a little while, but it was like, yeah, all right, let's get the fuck up out of here. Because she could cook. It was like nice. And she told us, oh, yeah, we're going over grandma's for Christmas, you know. And we got all ready, got all packed all stuff up. And then, you know, Christmas came and went, and and then she didn't come back again. So like, what? And I was the last one to know, you know. And I was so furious. I was so furious. Because it was in the middle. It was in the middle of arguing with one of the kids there. You know, and it was like, you know, and I don't know, I definitely didn't have the balls to say fuck you, but I was saying something to that effect, whatever the kid equivalent of that was. But I was like, fuck you, I can't wait till we go home, you know. And the kid was like, what, you live here? And I was like, no, the fuck we don't. And I remember going around asking everybody, like,
this is your auntie's?
No, this is at my brother's grandma's house.
Oh, okay.
So we were living okay. We were living with our aunt.
Gotcha.
And then we went to visit there for Christmas, but in reality we had been put in foster care.
Holy shit.
And when I found out I think it was the first time in my life that I was ever enraged. And I at the time I couldn't have put a word on it, but yeah. I was so fucking angry and I felt so powerless. I was so angry. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. That was the first little straw. And then they started making you go to therapy right off the bat, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember them trying to prescribe me Ritalin when I was like 6 or 7 years old, right? Which was, I forget what they call it now, what they're giving the kids, but it's—
Are you a hyper kid?
I was diagnosed with, it wasn't ADHD back then, it was just ADD, ADD. Right? Yeah. And they prescribed me Ritalin. I wasn't a hyper kid, I was I just wanted to do.
You
I was
became
just,
easily bored by something, and your brain moved on to the next thing.
Right, just which is weird because they see that as a weakness, which I don't think it is anymore. But anyway, they try to give me the pill, and it tastes like shit, so I didn't take it. And then I remember, like after a couple of weeks or a month or two of doing it, I remember going to the parent teacher conference, and the teacher and the school. To get the guidance counselor and all of them, they were all sitting around patting themselves on the back, like, oh, I see the progress and all this, and not knowing that I wasn't taking the pill. And I'm sitting there like, my language wasn't the same, but the sentiment was the same. I was just like, these motherfuckers are full of shit.
That was the second straw.
That was the second straw, but that was all it took for me. You know, I was just like, man, I'm just gonna. At that time, I wasn't 1,000% rebellious,
right?
But I was. That's what got me going. I was like, whatever I get the opportunity, I'm gonna do what I want.
Would it be safe to say that you realized that you can't depend on anybody, and that you alone are in charge of your destiny? Or was it just those group of people you couldn't depend on?
No, it was definitely not that. You know, because at the, like, if you had asked me at the time, I would have said, this is the worst. These are the worst people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're mean, because that was my word for everything. Like, they're mean, you know. But looking back on it with hindsight, I just think it was, It was very similar to what happened to me in school, but emotionally, right? Where it's like you would go, you know, you get sent to a new school in the middle of the school year, and you get there, and the curriculum is different, or the class is in a different spot, or you just in a completely different classes than you were at your last place, and you're just behind, right? And it's the same thing. It's like you go to a new home, and the emotional foundation is different. Like the basics are different. So what's expected of you is, you know, it's assumed that you already have certain shit. For example, it's like when I lived with my grandma, I was like, she was on top of everything we did. You know, it was like if you walked in the house, she was like, where's your homework? You know, she wanted to look at it. She wanted to see it. She wanted to make sure you understood it and all of this. But this new foster home, she had too many kids to be doing that shit. So it was just like, you know, it was like, do you have homework? Yes or no? Okay, well, if your report card coming and you don't have good grades, you can get your ass whooped. But I'm not going to be on top of it every single day, you know?
Gotcha.
And that's what I mean. Or it's like, just like little stuff like that, where it's like you become like an like an outsider, an emotional outsider in the tribe, you know.
What's that feel like?
I don't know. It felt normal to me. Like after a while, it just felt like normal. That's the thing. You don't realize. Like I didn't walk around like feeling like some fucked up kid. You know, I didn't realize
You didn't say out loud my emotional needs are not being met.
Right? No. I just didn't. And I think I was, you know, I frustrated a great many therapists because I very rarely did I open up to any of them.
As a kid, you mean in therapy?
Yeah. Because this was the last straw. I remember being sent to therapy one time and the therapist, you know, going through their whole rigmarole, the whole, you know, you can trust me but you know, unless you say you're gonna hurt yourself and all that other stuff. And we go through this long, you know, session or whatever, and then I'm like, all right, take it easy. She's like, oh no, just wait. You know, just wait in the lobby. I have to talk to your foster mom or whatever. And then she spent like 30 minutes talking to her, you know. And after that, I remember being like, you know, wait a minute. What were you talking to her about? She's like, oh, just some stuff. It was like they had a secret. Because like, you ain't in therapy, motherfucker. Why does what y'all talking about have to be a secret, you know? Because she just told me that whatever I said to her is between me and her. So what the fuck is she talking to you about? You
right.
know what I mean? And they wouldn't tell me, you know. And I'm like, fuck this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so every time they try to send me to therapy, I would just sit there until, and you know, after about four or five of those sessions, they'd stop one. Nice. They'd be like, this is pointless, you know? And so.
Have there been, I guess I should say, are there things in your life where that feeling of rage comes up again? Situations where you can remember feeling rage that intensely as you did when you were lied to?
Yeah, because I think my rage is often rooted in things not making sense, you know, not adding up, you know.
Not necessarily people being deceptive.
Right, but I would definitely be upset with someone being deceptive and definitely be mistrustful of someone that I thought was being deceptive. But if they had no reason to be, like no logical reason that I could ascertain why they're being deceptive, that is what would make me enraged, when I was like, you're just being evil for the sake of it. Like, you know, like you're the Joker or something, you know?
Right. Right.
It's like, I have this like desperate need to make sense of things, you know?
That makes sense.
And so it's like people that try to hurt you for no reason, mm-hmm. are the people that, like, you know, I got no sympathy for.
Are there any examples that you can think of?
No, not really. Like a mass shooter, like somebody that's like a mass, because I talk about this on stage a little. It hasn't really gotten into work yet, but it's like,
really, your mass shooting bit isn't bringing the house down.
Well, just this little piece of it.
Yeah.
But it's like, I would have far more sympathy for a student that went back to school and shot the motherfucker that was picking on them, rather than just shooting up everybody in the class.
Right.
Right? Because it's senseless. Right. You know, and that's what would enrage me. Where it's like, oh, that dude put your face in a toilet every morning. Yeah, okay, I get it. I get it. You know, not that I necessarily agree with what you did.
Yeah, I see.
But I get it. You killed him because he was fucking with you.
Yeah.
But you just kill anyone? Like, you don't even care? Like, this with just innocent people?
Right.
That, I can't get past it.
So it's a, to relax, you want to at least know what the rules are.
I don't know. I guess I've never really, but I guess that's a good way of putting it. That's a good way of putting it. I need to know.
The landscape.
It's got to add up.
Yeah.
You know?
What's the next stage of your life?
So I
did. And don't let me put words in your mouth. You know, sometimes I like to sit here and pontificate and summarize and, you know, don't let me do that if I'm misrepresenting.
You're doing pretty good.
Okay.
So then I end up, so I joined the military to like get away.
Cause you didn't like authority.
Well, you know what? Honestly, it was just for me. It was just about making my own decision. That's all it was. It was like,
was a financial element a part of it?
No, not at all. I mean, maybe a little bit, but no, what it really was just about not having someone else be in control of me. You know, like that.
Because, Hold on. How is going into the military somebody not having control of you? That seems like the ultimate version of that.
I know it seems sort of weird, but I didn't look at it that way because it was my way to freedom. Keep in mind, it's like I've been part of this institution that is PG County. PG County Child Protective Services or whatever it is. I've been a part of this institution my whole life. All you know, and now I'm 18, and it's like, you know, and I had just started their little program of they want to like they'll take care of you till you're 21 as long as you're in class, and you got to go, you know, they got to come and take you grocery shopping and come and take you clothes shopping once a month or twice a year or some shit, and I just was so over that. I was so over being them telling me
what to do.
It's just this organization that's like hovering over your life. And then every now and then they'll swoop down and fuck it all up and change it all around, you know. And I was just over that, you know. It was probably the smarter decision to stay in foster care and get my degree. But I was just like, fuck you. I'll join the military and get my degree that way, you know.
It also seems like the military would probably be more upfront about what it is that they expect of you, that there would be more logic to what the rules are. You know what I mean? Like,
well, I don't know if that's quite how I would put it.
I don't know. That's my interpretation as somebody who's never been in the military, is it seems like, you know, it's all about the rules. So you have them pounded into your head. You can do this. You can't do this.
Right.
Whereas it sounds like in when you were bouncing around from house to house, you were a bit off balance with what's okay and what's not.
Right. Well, I'll say that in the military, for the most part, the rules are pretty straightforward. Though a lot of them are up to the interpretation of, it's a pseudo meritocracy.
Right.
That doesn't turn into politics until you reach a certain rank, you know?
Right.
But for me, it was just a way through. I never had any intentions of staying. I didn't do it. I wasn't joining out of like patriotic reasons. And for a split second, I thought I wanted to be a grunt and like kill people. But then my recruiter was like, "No, you don't, dumbass." Because I scored pretty high on like the practice tests, you know. And he was like, "No, if you get this score on the real test, you can do whatever job you want. Almost, you know, you can get out and make money." You know, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. what am I thinking? Yeah, but for me, it was just a means to an end, you know, even though I'm so glad I did it because there was stability there that I never had.
Talk about that.
Because the unit I was in was, I got stationed in San Diego. And it was a temporary thing, you know, It was a temporary thing before I got there and a little bit after.
And this is the Marines?
Right. Mm-hmm. But my actual unit was in Yuma, Arizona. Mm-hmm. And then it was a temporary thing at this base. And then it got turned into a permanent thing. And so everyone that was there was sort of moved in the system from Yuma to San Diego. And so the one move that you usually do in your career, mm-hmm. that you usually have to do, I mean, per enlistment, I mean, it had technically happened for all of us already. So I never left. I never went anywhere else. I was never in no other unit. I was never in any other platoon. You know,
so, and that's a good thing or a bad thing, or
it's not a good thing or a bad thing, but it's just an unusual thing.
Right.
But it was great. It was a good thing for me because I'd never been in one place that long. I was there whole time, and with the same people. So not every single one, but all but like two or three of us were there our whole time.
And how many people is that?
I think there's probably, I don't know, I think I'm back on it. There's probably 40 or 50 of us. But I was only probably close to like 20 people.
Give me some snapshots of your time in the service, whether it was here or overseas.
What do you mean snapshots?
You know, little moments in time that are, you know, paint a picture of, you know, either the drudgery of it or the drama of it or something that dispels a myth about it. Just anything that kind of comes to mind. Even if it's something that's seemingly unimportant.
I've talked about my service a lot on other podcasts, but I don't know if I've ever brought up the fact that I did a lot of mushrooms at one point. That was probably the most transformative period of my entire life.
And what was your job in the platoon?
I was a
shaman.
No, I was a just for simplicity's sake, a radar technician. Even though I actually didn't fix the radar itself. I fixed the box that connected to it. The tactical. Gotcha. What the fuck do they call it? Tactical Air Operations Module, which probably doesn't even exist anymore.
Right.
Yeah, because I think as I was getting out, it turned from, it was a van about the size of this room, like 20 feet by 10 feet. And by the time I was leaving, they had put it in the back of a truck. And so it's probably now, it's probably just an app on a cell
probably.
Phone. Yeah. Who knows? Cause it's weird. That's the one thing where they weren't cheap about. But anyway, yeah, I was the only black person for a little while because they'd had some kind of racial incident before I got there. Mm-hmm. So I was like the first black person there.
In the platoon,
yeah. From the moment I got there. You know, gotcha. I really don't know that much about what happened before I got there, but because depending on who you ask, the story is different. But that was a significant thing. I remember doing... like my closest friend in the world, like still to this day, I remember he was new to the unit, and I remember we were at someone's house for Thanksgiving or some holiday or something like that, and they offered us weed, and neither one of us trusted each other, so we were both like, "Oh no, I would never, I would never do drugs." Are you kidding me? You know, and it's weird because we ended up doing a lot of drugs together. Like,
yeah.
We ended up I probably did mushrooms probably about 20 times,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little less, but that was the most. It completely changed my way of thinking. I think it was
how so?
Because
I think I understand what you're saying because I've also done hallucinogens, but
I think it was the first time I had ever stopped and reflected on like self-reflection, like self-examination in a way that was productive, you know.
Yeah, there are those moments sometimes where you go from the view where you are just stuck in the woods, your face is against a tree, to all of a sudden you're pulled out above the town, above the city, above the state, above the United States. And it's like you're looking at the globe and all of a sudden you see all of these patterns and these interlocking things and these, at least for me, those are the moments that felt, mind opening when I was doing hallucinogens was just seeing things from a different perspective. Is that something you can relate to at all, or not?
Yeah, definitely. Or just being aware that there was a such thing as perspective, you know.
For instance, any insights that you remember popping into your head, and what they felt like, or how you felt about yourself.
Yeah, I think probably the most powerful thing I took from that whole period, because it was probably like over the course of maybe like a year and a half. But the most powerful thing was just that that you can be who you choose. You know, that just that life isn't something that's just happening to you. Mm-hmm. You know, that you're a participant in it. And so you can affect who you are. You know, it was just, I don't know, it was such a profound thing for me at the time. It was like, oh, I can shape my own self.
How I react to the things I can't control.
Right. Or just like, I think before that I was just sort of a passive participant. Mm-hmm. In, you know, I only existed in the moment and not in the future or in the past and not in the future. Like I think I had just maybe never even considered the possibility that I could be a different person someday, or that I could be
in terms of your external circumstances or your personality and how you interact with the world, or all of the above.
Yeah, you know what it is? It's like the first time you see that there's a mirror, that you see a mirror and you're like, Oh, I can control how I'm perceived. I can control what this reflection is. You know, mm-hmm. That's what it is. Like I think it's been like I had never looked in a mirror before. You know, and now I was like, oh shit! Like I have to start. I can pay attention to. You know, I stopped feeling sorry for myself and stopped feeling victim, because I was sort of a victim of circumstance to some degree, but I also realized that like, whatever debt you feel the world owes you, it's never going to be paid, you know.
Wow, that's
the earth is in tremendous debt to a lot of people. Just the world, the universe. It's never going to pay you,
dude. That you is know? So going in the opening montage of next year's podcasts. It's such a great.
You already know what the opening montage of next year's podcast
is? I know that clip is going in there.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I thought you meant that you already had a montage.
No, when somebody says something that really hits me, I'll often say to them, that's going in next year's opening montage, because it's I like to find little snippets that kind of encapsulate the vibe of the podcast, the great moments of the podcast, and that one just was such a condensed version of what this podcast is about.
Oh, okay. I'm still not quite sure what the podcast is about. But don't tell me. Don't wait after. Let's
share some overseas memories if you can.
You know, a lot of that is kind of a blur. It was mostly just boring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's no PTSD
just
or
boredom. I mean, I definitely think that I think it definitely exacerbated a lot of mental stuff that I because you know what it is that after I joined the military before 9/11, so I didn't, you know, I didn't have patriotic reasons. I wasn't trying to be a hero and none of that. I was just trying to make it out in one piece with my college money.
So what were the years you were in?
2001 and 2006. So I joined in March of 2001.
And
then,
oh, wow.
And then and 9/11 happened like 6 months later. And
did you think, fuck?
Yes. Yes. I was real upset because now there's stakes, you know, it's like, and you have to have trust in, you know, there are people above you that are not competent.
Who control your life.
Right. And luckily for me, like the people directly above us were pretty competent, most of them. But it's like there's such a long chain of people that have to, just marginally know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And you have to trust it. It's like, I don't. I never trust the government to get anything, because they're going to cut corners. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to give you expired shit. They're going to have you in the wrong place. You know, you find out afterwards, you always find out afterwards that, these people only survive because, they just so happen to stumble. You know, people have so much trust in the machine, and I did not.
Was there any element of also being worried, being a person of color, that you would be treated differently?
Of course.
Talk about that.
That was a constant worry for me, but just because, you know what it is? Because a lot of racism is, it's systemic. And the military is America, and so it's just a sample, it's like if you took a eyedropper and dipped it into America and pulled it out. I mean, that's what the military is, right? And so, but the difference is that people above you in rank have absolute authority over you, at least the closest that it could be in America to someone that, so it's like, what are the chances of you encountering a racist that has unquestionable power over you? Like, as long as they don't straight up call you a racial slur, directly, because they don't even have to, because they can just fucking screw with your life, but it's weird, because I think you get so used to being treated like shit anyway, that even if it's like I would have a hard time looking back and figuring out what happened because I was black and what happened for some other dumbass reason.
You would have a hard time, or you wouldn't?
I would. I would have a hard time knowing what
was malicious and what was just incompetence.
Well, it's all malicious, But I would have a hard time separating, what were the times that this happened because of racism or for some. Because, this person's an asshole. They're being an asshole to me. And it's like, but also almost everyone's an asshole in the Marine Corps. So it's like, sussing out their motivations is almost impossible. But I'm sure it happened.
What's your thing about pennies?
The pennies joke. Did I do that on?
You did.
What do you mean? You want me to do the bit?
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to perform it, but how does it go again?
That America looks at black people the way cashiers look at pennies.
Yeah.
Illegally, they have to accept us everywhere, but if you walk in with more than a handful, everyone's like, what the fuck is going on? Right. And that's what I learned. I learned so much about white people from the Marine Corps.
Talk about that.
Just because I was just given a triple dose of it, just just immersed. I mean, the thing is, being black in America, you're already immersed in white culture outside of your own stuff. But this was a whole different thing because outside of any kind of institution, you don't really have to conform, But this was a weird thing, and I spent a lot of time frustratedly trying to explain racial stuff to white people. I gave up, I got a couple of people in the fold, but it was a mostly fruitless.
Any moments you can remember that were fruitful or fruitless?
Not any moments in particular, but I just know, I know that it's like, was it Remember the Titans? What movie was that? Where they?
With Denzel?
Right. Where when he brought the team together, they all came together because they were from a racist town, but when he took them apart and they all blah, blah, blah. But as soon as they got back to the town, Mm-hmm. It was back to business. You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know. I know that that you know, the military is tough because you're given an identity, you know, and you have your whole lives in common. But when it's over, what's left, right? Like, how much of what you had in common was just that I think that's true of any job that is also a lifestyle, right? Whether it be a cop or a musician or a comedian or whatever, it's like you have everything in common as long as this is your job, as long as this is your life.
Right.
And then as soon as that's over with, you're back to just being somebody from, like, that's all, we don't have anything, we're nothing alike, you know? So I don't know who is what back in their hometown, you know?
Yeah. I always think about the really, really top-notch athletes and what that's got to be like sitting on their couch the first day of the next season, you know, that they've retired.
Oh, man.
That has to be, you know, money aside and all that other stuff, that has to be a difficult adjustment. Anybody, I suppose, who's in the spotlight and just is used to this certain world that's been that way since they were probably in Little League or playing peewee football.
That's why I like stand up, because that's the profession where people don't expect you to stop when you're getting older.
You know? I didn't think I'd ever stop. I thought I'd be doing it until, you know, whenever. And honestly, I still love writing jokes. I just got tired of the road. I got tired of, you know, terrible feature act being put on in front of me and then just, you know, having to struggle for five shows because, you know, it was just a barrage of loud dick jokes setting up, you know, the show before I got on. Right. Being away from home, that's probably the biggest thing is the traveling, the airports.
Yeah. And now, you know, what's so weird is like, showbiz in general, but stand-up in particular has become so exploitative. You know,
how so?
Because comics now are shamelessly underpaid.
Because they need the quote-unquote exposure? That's the thing they get used to leverage?
Some of it is just because it's so saturated, so oversaturated, that there's always a comedian willing to do it for that amount of money. So,
I gotcha. So what's the average feature act make on the road for, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or a Thursday through Sunday?
I think it's different. It's different for everybody. But I'll just say this: if you featuring on the road, mm-hmm. you pretty much have to hope that the headliner lets you sell merch, you know,
T-shirts and CDs. Yeah, and stuff
basically,
like
any comic that's getting paid decently is because, like, any unknown comic that's mm-hmm. getting paid decently is because someone is being a good person. Someone just went out of their way to be a better person than they have to be, because most promoters are scum. But I think that's probably true in every industry, but.
That was the true when I was doing stand up. I started in 87, and you know, I was fortunate enough to have started when the comedy boom was underway. So you didn't have to be great to get stage time. They were just looking for warm bodies. And then when it just kind of collapsed in the early 90s because it was oversaturated, that's when the real comedy business emerged, and you kind of found out what the marketplace looks like in terms of your power to say yes or no, or you know, who are the good club owners and who are the bad ones. And there was a few good ones.
There are. And now I think there's a bubble again, mm-hmm. and an oversaturation again. And you know, who knows? And that's the thing. I know that the industry has always been this way. It's hard to resist the temptation to assume that all our problems are brand new.
Right. You know? That's one of the disappointing things about getting older, yeah. You know, and especially being a fan of documentaries, is you, like, watch a documentary on the Gilded Age, the late 1800s, and all of the wealth was held by, like, 10 people.
Right.
And they thought that they had cured that with all of these antitrust laws, and here we are again, 120 years later, and it's the exact same fucking thing. Yeah.
Technology fools us into believing that we have made some sort of progress as a species, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, it doesn't matter if it's a sword or a laser beam, you know, rail gun or whatever. It's like, we're still the same human beings.
Right. Has decency evolved? That's the question.
Well, just technology evolves faster than the human. I think the human capacity to fuck up is the fastest evolving part of us. Technology is just a different way for us to fuck things up.
It's just sped up the accidents.
It's just, I think every time we make any advancement, it's just that anything that can do good can do harm, right? I mean, pretty much like when we discover gunpowder. You know, we discovered electricity, we discovered nuclear. It can all be used for good or bad. And it's like, we haven't matured at all. You know, what makes us different from the...
Don't think there's been any evolution in terms of emotional literacy? No. I feel like there is a segment of the population that is becoming more enlightened. And while I think it's the minority, I feel like... There has always been that movement, but I feel like it's growing.
I don't know. See, and this is me being cynical, I guess. But
maybe because I'm not in comedy clubs anymore. That's the way.
I think that, you know, there's always that feeling. I just don't know how true it is because, you know, it's not a coincidence that we feel morally superior to people from the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, you know, and I don't know if I necessarily have the answer, but my question is it that we're morally superior to the people in the past, or is it that we're the ones that get to measure? Everyone in, you know, at every present, you know, and in the future, they're going to look back on us and go, you know, it's like, are we better than them? Or is it just that we get to say what's best because we exist now? Because every generation has thought they were better than the previous one, right? So
I feel like there are some things that we've improved on and there are some things that we've gotten worse at.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the overall grade is.
Because here's the deal. We still have all the same problems and on a larger scale. So
just tip your mic up a tiny bit if you want. Yeah,
we still have all the same problems and on a larger scale. So are we, I mean, even our morally superior people, are they morally superior to the morally superior people from the previous, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
So maybe just the weapons we use to harm each other and the presents we give each other have changed. And
our way of pretending to help. That's a big one. Or like doing things to make us feel like we're doing things.
You know what annoys me probably more than anything is the people, the benefactors that have a wing of a hospital named after them, and they've spent most of their lives amassing a fortune built on the backs of exploited people.
Yeah.
And then they get to have a ball where everybody dresses up and lauds them and talks about how great they are. And have you ever seen the movie Arbitrage?
No.
Arbitrage. It's with Richard Gere, and it's about that very thing, about the 1% and the kind of the two-faced nature of their lives and the benefactors and the donating of things.
Everyone is obsessed with the Succession. You watched that?
It's amazing.
It is amazing.
Oh my God. I cannot wait for next season. And I think it's also really satisfying because it's clearly pointed at the Fox News empire. It's, you know, I'm sure they would deny it, but the parallels between that and the Murdoch family are way too coincidental to not be intentional. And so it feels like those of us that disagree with that worldview are having our voices heard.
Yeah.
But you probably wouldn't know what it's like to not have your voice heard.
Right. No, I wouldn't.
Let me tell you about it. I got an email from somebody a couple of months ago that said, why do you only ask about race when you have guests who are persons of color? And I said, well, the kind of the default view on race is everywhere, the white view on race. We hear it everywhere. You look at our media, you look at it, whether it's outspoken or not, whether it's you know, kind of written between the lines or not, it's not hard to discern what somebody's view of race is when they make a TV show or they make something else. It's there, or the stories they choose to put on the front page of a newspaper. So it's everywhere. The people that kind of own our culture. And so my point was, I want to hear about it from peoples whose voices have been marginalized historically. And I was honestly a little baffled by it. What are your thoughts?
On race or on white people?
On that
email?
Yeah, if you were to answer that email, what would you say? Because while I understand that, yeah, I could ask my white guests about race, and I'm sure that there would be some insights there. It's not the most pressing question to me when I have somebody sitting across from me for an hour. And so I guess I'm looking to learn more about when do you talk about race? When do you not talk about race?
Well, see, I got that criticism a lot from that TV spot.
Why? What were the criticisms?
Well, just, you know, which I already knew they were coming because I've had this conversation 1,000 times, you know, and so I knew what the criticism was going to be, but it was just, oh, you know, another black dude bringing up racism, you know, how original, and, you know, or, you know, racism only exists because you bring it up so much, or, you know, all of the.
What does that feel like when you hear somebody say something like that?
For me, it's just, it's such an old song to me that I'm just like, I mostly feel pity for the person.
So you don't feel anger?
No, not anymore. No, very few things really make me angry. Like it would have to be like gross injustice or something like that to like piss me off. Mm-hmm. But
that email,
I think I would say to that person, like, you, like, see, because you, have you ever been in a situation where like someone in your house is playing music or has the television on, but they're not watching it. Mm-hmm. And you come in the room and change it to something that you want to watch. And then they go, hey, I was fucking... What? That's what white people do with race, right? Where it's like there's this ubiquitous background. Like you said, the white perspective is everywhere. And it's so... the word escapes me, but it's so damn...
It's universal.
Yeah, ubiquitous, right? Yeah. It's so everywhere, yeah. That when at the moment you don't hear it anymore is when you start... The moment you don't hear it's the cosmic microwave whiteness, mm-hmm. right? And the moment you hear anything else, that's when you notice.
Right.
You know, and so it's like people of color are just those people walking in the room going, oh, no one's watching this. Well, let me just real quick check the game. And you go, hey, motherfucker, what are you doing? Why are you always changing the channel? And it's like, well, you always watching, which, you know, it's the same thing. It's like America is constantly focused on, you know, the white perspective, you know, and right now, cause what I always say, cause sometimes I could heckle this, you know, and it's like, and my thing has always been, you know, you only have to hear about racism for the rest of my set, but I gotta be black forever. So, you know, it's like, you know, if your stake is that, cause I don't know this person, so I don't know if they're one of these people that thinks like racism doesn't exist or something like that, but it's like,
no, this person was definitely not of that. No, I wouldn't say that they thought that I was being racist, but they thought that I was perhaps being, in terms of the broader view of race, that I was being narrow in when to talk about it, who to talk about it with, that it was kind of a low level bias.
Right. Well, to me, that's like a micro, though. It's like the what about me-isms, you know, it's the, you know, and maybe it's subconscious, but it's like, I guarantee your view about race wouldn't surprise me, you know, because it's one of two things. Cause like I told you, I spent so much of my life trying to make or having to make white people comfortable. Mm. Right. And so, and when I started doing comedy, I stopped doing that, you know? And so,
Did that feel freeing?
I mean, not necessarily. I realize that it's just more effective. It's more effective, you know, because most of the time, just from my experience, most of the time when someone is asking me to, when a white person is asking me to explain something racial to them, I have to determine whether this person is really trying to learn or if they just want me to make them feel better about some racist shit they did or said or view that they hold. Because that's what it is most of the time.
Right.
Is it's they want, they're not listening, they're not hearing me. They want me to make them feel okay about the shit they're already doing. you know?
Gotcha.
And so.
Are there any particular instances or subjects that you can recall that?
I mean, fuck, there's so many. Black Lives Matter. You know, when you hear the All Lives Matter, like ask yourself, what is that rooted in? Mm-hmm. You know, in some cases it's willful ignorance or whatever, but so, you know, so often I'm in a situation where, I can't think of anything specific off the top of my head. It's just so often I'm in a situation where where I'm asked to explain race, some racial thing, or I'm asked what I think about some racial thing. And then in the middle of the conversation, I get somebody will say something like, so you know, like, have you ever been, like rolling in the conversation, going back and forth and back and forth. And then the person you're talking to goes on a tangent as if you agree with everything they're saying. Like that sort of thing. Like, okay. You know what? A big one is saying the N word, you know, can you say the N word to black people? And it's like, no,
right.
You know, but it's like, don't try to assert it on me, you know, cause to me, it doesn't have to make sense. You know, it just is. It's just a rule. You know, it's just a respect thing. It's, you know, it's the same reason why I don't have a problem trying to call trans people by their pronouns and stuff like that. You know, I mean, at least try to be respectful. You know, because it's like stop and ask yourself: Did you start thinking about racism only when you thought it could apply to you?
Right. When it became inconvenient or quote unquote annoying to you.
Right. Exactly. Oh, I do have a specific situation. I remember being in Iraq and my last deployment, we were attached to a reserve unit. My platoon was attached to this reserve unit. I think what the fuck was the fourth lab? So we were attached to this division that we weren't a part of at all. Mm-hmm. And so we were, so there were all these people that we had never, that we didn't know. Mm-hmm. And they were reservists, which is a big line in the military, right? And so
it's kind of the difference between a cop and a mall cop, or is that too severe?
No, that's too severe. It isn't really the difference between a cop and a mall cop, but it's more like
a doctor and an EMT.
No, it's more like it's like the difference between a hobby comic and a road comic. You know, it's like,
I gotcha. And apologies to any reservists out there.
I don't apologize. I don't apologize to you.
No, from my.
Oh, from him. Yeah,
from me calling you a mall cop.
But I remember. So we're around people that we haven't known that like very long, and I remember being in a situation where where we lived. You know, there's like six of us in a 20 by 10 space. Like we have two, you know, it's like bunk beds. It's three bunk beds in a room just a little bigger than this. Mm-hmm. Right. But we had ours was decked out. You know, we had a couch in there. We had a TV. Like we wheeled and dealed and bought shit from the locals, and we ended up with an Xbox and all of the stuff that like we shouldn't have had, looking back on it, but everybody would end up in our space at the end of the night sometimes because we were the only people that had any of that stuff. So I remember, I don't remember what was on TV or someone read an article, and it was something where the lead singer of Pantera had like said something to that effect, like, you know, like white people are under attack or something like that. And I just remember everybody looking at me like, what do you think? You know, and I'm the only black person, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that was one of those situations where it was like, nothing I said was penetrating that cloud, you know, because they didn't want to really hear what I thought. They just wanted me to affirm
the moment. Okay.
Exactly. And I'm like, you know, that's I can't tell you how many times I've answered the question of like, why is there a black entertainment television? It's not a white, and you know, that kind of thing where it's like this, it's the white.
They don't understand that the white is the default.
It's the right. But there's this insecurity, you know,
right.
That it's just so many, it's just countless times I've had this conversation. And you know what it is too, is it's something you have to actively work on. It's not something that's just gonna feel better, you know. And it's not any minority's job to like make you feel better. It's nice when you meet, when you get a minority friend that's willing to answer all your questions and all of that, but I'm retired. That's a young man's game, you know. I've spent so many years doing it, and I'm just over being, if anybody's first black friend, I'm not going to do it again. You know,
there was a guy that I went to college with who will sometimes post things on Facebook that, are the polar opposite of the things that I believe. And when the whole Black Lives Matter movement started, this person said, well, why aren't these people protesting the black gang members killing each other? And I said, because we don't pay gang members to protect us.
Right.
They're not being paid by our tax dollars. And the fact that somebody couldn't see the difference between a systemic institutionalized thing and something completely different. I mean, yes, they're both tragedies that people are being killed, but I just can't. And I know that I have things that I can be more enlightened on, and that I have blind spots.
It's got to click. It's got to click. Because I bet you. So are you familiar with Old Town Road?
Mm-mm.
So there was a country song called. So.
Oh, the thing that's a gigantic hit that
right.
was done by the
Lil Nas X.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's like the most downloaded song ever, or something.
I don't know about ever, but definitely last year for sure.
Yeah.
But you know, I can't tell you how many times I've tried to explain cultural appropriation, or I've had to answer a question like, "What is that?"
They tried to do the double standard of them. They're taking white culture.
Right. Well, I just think there may be a handful of white people out there that it hit them. You know, they had this epiphany of, oh shit. Not everybody, but I'm sure some people did, you know, when it was like, because the controversy on that song, which I guess is not even a controversy anymore. But they took it off the country charts. Right. It was initially trending on the country charts and then Billboard took it off after pressure from, I don't know, the country world or whatever, because and their reasoning was that it wasn't clearly country. You know, it wasn't country enough, you know, and then a lot of people made the argument of, well, you know, he didn't move to Nashville and like get into the culture, and, you know, they were afraid that he was just a culture vulture. They was afraid that he was just doing country to make a buck but not really gave a shit about country. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I always thought, like, you know, that is a perfect example of like what those people were afraid of is cultural appropriation, what black people complain about.
Right.
Right. But some of those same people will say it doesn't exist.
Right.
Or it's just something people are crying about. Right. And here's the cosmic justice, right? Is that, Miley Cyrus is one of the biggest perpetrators of this, you know, because there was a little point in her career where she started hanging out with rappers and ball players and started making more hip hop, blah, blah, blah. And then as soon as it started hurting her image, she dropped it. She was like, oh, I don't really believe in those things and so on and so forth. And here's the real cosmic karma is that what got Lil Nas X back on the country charts was that he put Billy Ray Cyrus on the remix. Because that's the song. If you've heard that song, it's probably you heard the remix with Billy Ray Cyrus on it.
Yes, I did.
Right. And that was not the original song. But he is the one, you know, I think it's just funny because Miley Cyrus is his daughter, who is one of the biggest offenders of cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. And he was the remedy to assuage the white fears that was happening to them.
So is it culturally appropriating something for any white person to do?
I don't know.
Hip hop?
I think there's ongoing debate about that. I don't know.
I mean, like, what about the Beastie Boys? How do you view them? Because to me, they seem to have put their own spin on it rather than just taking something and repurposing it without adding anything to it.
It is weird why certain people get a pass and certain people don't.
Do you think it has to do with authenticity?
Yeah, I think it has to do with authenticity. I think it has to do with being of whether you of the culture, you
right.
know, because I don't think the Beastie Boys were hip hop, you know.
You think they were? Or
yeah,
they weren't.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
At the time. They were
right.
They weren't. It wasn't just something that they were pretending to
right.
be, right? So and that's a hard I don't know if there's a if it's a black and white hard and fast rules. But you know, it's one of the things where you know it when you see it.
You know it when you see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Vanilla Ice, that was cultural appropriation.
Of course.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know Vanilla. I mean, cuz now what was he? He does rock and roll now, right?
He was a home remodeler last time I saw. He was doing the flipping houses, but that was a long time ago. I don't know. I'm pretty out of touch. I'm pretty out of touch.
I'm mostly a hermit myself. I only leave the house when I have to.
Do you live with anybody?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Of course.
Married? Kids?
Nope. No, none of that.
Yeah.
No, we just roommates. I think
you get along?
I'm not surprised in Hollywood if anyone has roommates. Like, you could be in your 50s and you're like, I live with five people. I'm like, yeah, of course you do.
Yeah, it's expensive. It's expensive. Yeah,
yeah, it's super expensive.
Somebody that doesn't live here, a barely nice two-bedroom apartment in a so-so neighborhood is at least $1,500.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about? We didn't really talk about depression.
Oh yeah, that was the whole point of this.
No, it wasn't. It was one of the things that made me want to interview you. But you know, if there's any subject we've talked about the most on this podcast, it's been depression. So it's not like we have to get to this. But if there's anything that you want to share about your battles with depression, when did it start?
Oh yeah, well I definitely had. I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder a few years ago, which I've always known. But I think if I'm being honest, I think it started way back when, but I just didn't know.
Mm-hmm. How does it present itself? Like difficulty getting out of bed, trouble making decisions.
I feel I get numb. I think a lot of people that aren't depressed, they think it's being sad.
Right.
And it's like, if I wish I could feel sad when I was depressed, but it's not. It's feeling nothing.
Feeling nothing. Yep. It's a gray blanket. Yeah. It's just all the color leaves, and it's just meh.
Yeah, it's like a feeling. Like, imagine you're a horror. Have you ever had a split second where you thought you couldn't feel your legs or something like that? It's like, imagine that before for your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's like. It's like being completely emotionally crippled.
Andrew Solomon, who is the author of Noonday Demon and another book, the name escapes me, but really, guy has written extensively about depression. And in a TED talk, he said, the opposite of depression isn't happiness, it's vitality. And I went, yeah, that is such a great way of describing it.
Yeah, it's like it's living.
It's living.
Yeah.
Feeling a part of the stream of life.
Yeah, and I
are there ways you soothe yourself? Finish your thought first.
I do. I mean, I think it's a constant thing because I can never. I don't. There's never for me. There's never a one time thing for it. I find that it happens less often when I'm making healthier choices.
For instance.
Just when I'm not, you know, eating a bunch of fried foods and when I'm, you know, exercising regularly, when I'm sleeping.
How about opening up to people? Do you ever get vulnerable with people or share your feelings?
I also have the intimacy issues from my childhood. So that's hard for me.
Go ahead.
No, what were we going to ask?
I was going to say, is that something that you have any desire to work on, or are you okay with where it's at?
No, I'm working on it. I'm working on it. I think I keep telling...
You seem like you're trying to convince yourself that you're working on it.
No, I think I keep telling myself that... You know, I think, I mean, I don't know if I've ever explicitly said it, but I think my general plan is that I have to, it's not a priority until I'm successful enough to be able to focus on not survive. Cause you know, cause out here is like, that's why a lot of mental health shit gets worse out here is because.
Right. But why does it have to be mutually exclusive?
Because I think you just have to put so much energy into survival, you know, that it's not impossible. That's not true.
Right.
But it's easy to believe that it is. It's easy to believe that you just need to eat and sleep and occasionally have some sex and you'll be good till the next.
I think also, you know, one of the hallmarks of depression is that everything feels overwhelming. So the idea of going to get help, going to a support group, seeing a psychiatrist, you know, whatever it is, you know.
Well, see, my big issue is with the VA. It's just that because there was talk for a while of making this so that you could go to any hospital and the VA would pay for it. Mm-hmm. But now you can only do that if it's an emergency. And even then, still, I think it's only certain hospitals. And you know, and how are you supposed to know that in an emergency? But the point is, you know, the fact that, like, because I don't drive, the fact that I have to go all the way out Westwood whenever I have any appointment at all, that means it's all day. It's an all day thing. I can't do anything else that day, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's a 2.5 hour drive. I mean, a ride out there because you got to, because the public transport is so unreliable that you can't plan it down to the minute. You have to plan it, like, give yourself a 45-minute window, you know, mm-hmm. so that in case you miss a bus or something comes late or leaves early. And so, you know, it's a 2-3 hour trip there and then a 2-3 hour thing while you're there and then a 2-3 hour trip back, you know. And so you're the way they schedule things is like sometimes, man, I don't have my whole day to give the VA, you know. Yeah. It's like, I wish I could do that shit over Skype. Yes. It's like, I came all the way out here just to talk to you.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
I'm going to do a shameless plug, but one of our sponsors is BetterHelp. And I do online therapy from that easy chair over there every Monday afternoon. And
really?
It's fucking great.
Is it expensive?
It's less expensive than most in-person therapy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what about the confidentiality and all of that?
It's same thing. Same as a... I'll talk to you more about it off the air. I don't want to do a plug
nah,
here for, but they've been a sponsor for 2 years, and I've had the same online therapist for 2 years, and she has helped me through a lot of shit. And I just love not having to get in my car.
To do
stuff.
That's a big one. Yeah.
You know what? Maybe I'll talk to them and see if
they'll sponsor my podcast.
If they'll sponsor your podcast. Yeah, and then maybe get you some complimentary things, and you can try it and see if you like it.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you want to share before we wrap up?
No, not really.
I feel like we covered a lot.
It was a lot. It was.
Yeah.
How long have we been talking?
Hour and 17 minutes.
Oh, wow. No, that didn't feel like that long.
Yeah. Dude, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you. And, again, I love your stand up and anybody listening, go check out his stuff. You got any road dates coming up? Although I have no idea when this is going to air. So let me drive right, to your website.
Yeah, no, just go to my Instagram.
Okay.
The BS Comedian on Instagram, yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks for having me. Man.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. We only have one survey post interview. And this is a happy moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Jesus Doesn't Believe in Me. And he writes, after spending most of my life knowing my mere presence was a burden to those around me, I had a couple of good days. I was leaving the mental health support group I go to when two people I'd never seen in the group before asked if I wanted to hang out. I was too anxious to say yes right away. I made the excuse of having to check on my diabetic dog. I did, but it could have waited several hours. They texted me a bit after I got home and asked me if I wanted to go bowling and grab some food. I did want to go, so I gathered all my courage and went. It was a blast, and we made definitive plans to hang out again less than a week later. Then two guys who host a nerdy podcast that I love asked me to be the guest on the next episode. I hadn't asked these people to be included. They asked me to join. Since then, the couple I met at group have become some of my best friends of all time. We have standing plans to hang out every Monday and Thursday, and I was asked to join the podcast as a third host. The help I get from my growing support system of friends gave me the clarity of mind to end an extremely toxic relationship. I'm not a piece of shit. I'm a person, and now I can accept that. Oh, I love when I hear stories about people creating a support network and finally feeling love and trust and support and healthy boundaries and being able to start experiencing intimacy and vulnerability. And it's makes my day. Makes my day. Well, I hope you got something out of this episode. And if you're struggling, especially this time of year, hang in there. You are not the only one. I can tell you that kind of can't wait for January 2nd to roll around. Oh, that's a weird date too, because that's the date my dad died in 2006. Let's say January 3rd. Let's do that. And let's end the show with you picturing my dead dad. Let's do that. I think Santa would enjoy that. Just remember, you're not alone, and thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely.